Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Stengary. Even with the greatest intentions, change doesn't tend to happen without a well-structured plan and some weight behind it. Otherwise, you have a long, slow parade that can wander off the path to success and eventually maybe lose its way. That's why next Wednesday and Thursday, the Summit on the Future of Vermont will be held to ensure that a clear roadmap forward is agreed upon and constructed. Here to talk about the summit and the propositioned the Vermont proposition that will be presented is Allie Richards. She's CEO of Let's Grow Kids and a board member for the Vermont Council on Rural Development. Allie, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. And Paul Costello, Executive Director of VCRD. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's great to be here.
Great. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask about the summit or maybe add comments about the future of Vermont, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Before we get into the summit, Paul, I always like to back up and start and give everybody a little primer, make sure that we're all on the same page. So I want to make sure everybody understands what the Council on Rural Development is and what your mission is.
Thanks so much. VCRD is charged by the Federal Farm Bill to help coordinate state and federal policy to support rural communities. We have a board that bridges private sector, local leadership with members of the cabinet of the governor, federal agency heads, the heads of congressional offices, all working together to think outside of the silos and think beyond politics to kind of lay out what we hear from rural communities. So fundamentally, we're a group that helps communities come together and line up and set action plans and then connect to resources. And we do similar sorts of convening based on what we learn locally for state policy.
Allie, as CEO of Let's Grow Kids, why is this a board that you are interested in being a member of?
Oh, I love that question. So Let's Grow Kids is a statewide movement for high-quality, affordable childcare. So, you know, we only exist because there are unprecedented levels of support by Vermonters from all sectors and all backgrounds saying this is one identified need in their lives. And so having the chance to work with the Council on Rural Development is a chance to really understand what communities need, what they're saying, how they're coming up with innovative solutions and leadership themselves to really identify and then tackle these problems. So it's kind of like a mini version of the whole Council on Rural Development's mission and this whole summit. As you'll see, similarly, you know, childcare is one of many propositions. It's sort of sitting at the Council on Rural Development table helps you see the wide landscape of Vermont and then these themes that run through all of our differences town to town.
Well, Allie, let's go right into the summit then. What is the goal of the summit that's being held next week, the Summit on the Future of Vermont?
Again, you know, that's the question we're all going to answer together. I think that what's been really exciting to work with Paul and the team on developing this is hearing from thousands of Vermonters, right? This isn't in a vacuum. This is the Council on Rural Development has these amazing community visits. They're some of the most effective work I've seen happen in Vermont. Really neutral, authentic, listening, be the guides for communities to be the masters of their own destiny. And all of these really large issues came to the fore. And I would also say, Rick, that the pandemic was sort of a final push for so many of these things. We've been on this precipice of needing to kind of rethink how we do business a little bit in Vermont to make sure we're entering this next phase as healthy and thriving as we can be. And I would say the pandemic kind of shone a light on both the stunning needs that we've all sort of known were there, but it kind of exposed them in this dramatic way, but also some stunning innovation that we have here in Vermont and as Vermonters. So I think that's where this comes from. And what we're hoping to accomplish together, I believe, is, you know, can we agree on not only some key themes and action items, but an actual plan to say, how are we prioritizing? What are the levers that will move these pieces forward? You started the show with this, Rick. You know, a vision is, you know, is really just a dream unless there's a plan behind it. You know, so data, a plan, again, I think prioritization. So how can we say, we know we may have to make some changes here as Vermonters to move forward on the things that we've identified that we just need, we need in our lives, as you see in these, the details of the proposition. And we need to hatch a plan.
Paul, is the summit a first for VCRD, or is this held regularly, and who participates?
Well, we've probably run 23 or 24 statewide rural summits that tend to have 500 people or so at them. We've held them, though, on topics ranging from the future of in-state energy development to the structure of planning to how to advance agriculture and working lands enterprises. And this is the probably 12 years ago we ran the Council on the Future of Vermont that was really the first time in a generation that Vermonters were pulled together to talk at, you know, a really deep level about what our values and common goals are as we think to the future. And we interviewed about 5,000 people. We did polls, trend line analysis, and just a great deal of research to pull together that platform. As we looked to where we have come since then at the board level, we started thinking, you know, we're really at a place where some of the long-term issues facing Vermont have been with us for a while, things like economic doldrums in some peripheral areas, some of the challenges to the rural economy, the demographic challenges that we've faced, issues that that have been challenging for us as a place. And then with COVID on top of that, we feel like we're kind of at a catalytic moment that we should be looking at not just, you know, what do we stand for and what our values are, but what are the actions that we could take in the next 3 years that would lever for economic and community success for the future of Vermont? What's going to attract the next generation to want to be Vermonters? What's going to welcome new Vermonters? And what are some of the ways that we can stimulate our economy, everything from working lands to technology in Vermont? So we set out to ask Vermonters these questions. And we had, Governor Scott had asked us to help lead his COVID recovery effort, particularly connected to local solutions, what towns were doing creatively, and to share some of those solutions between towns to help the whole state sort of leaven its way forward. Fascinating process. We interviewed over 1,000 people in that process to think about what does recovery look like and how do we work forward together, what's most essential. And in that process, we heard over and over again, universal broadband, the critical need for childcare, the essential need to advance food system resilience. You remember the beginning of the COVID thing in March last year, you know, suddenly store shelves were empty. And it wasn't just toilet paper, it was also meat and other things that we really weren't prepared from a resilience point of view to be able to have serve local needs. And so all these different issues kind of boiled on the table, and we started looking at them systemically and adding up some of the voices that we heard from. And then we determined to go out and interview former governors and interview historically marginalized folks, and younger people of color in Vermont, and business leaders, and sort of a cross-section of the diversity of the state to get their take on what the fundamental issues were. And then we set up sort of a prototype of ideas to test, and we built a survey where people didn't just say yes or no, they also got to write their own propositions for the future of Vermont. And we had probably 1,400 people write them. We have a 400 and some odd page pile of you know, every page with 20 ideas that came from Vermonters that we've sifted through and, you know, read thoroughly and, again, pulled strains of that together into this document that attempts to weave together some of the fundamental challenges and points of action that we could be taking for the future. So we'll be sharing that with summit attendees, and we'll be asking them, you know, have we got it right? You know, what are we missing? And then as we look at this platform of potential action, what are some of the strategies we could use to move these things forward? How would we work together? What are some of the partnerships between organizations that could be used to move this forward? And, you know, for us, we don't do this, you know, as Republicans or Democrats are thinking that we have all the answers. We do it with a lot of humility, saying, you know, let's really listen to each other at this point in our history. Let's add up some common direction, because this is really a fundamental moment where we need to come together in democracy and come together as a people to work as effectively as we can to optimize the best future for us and our children.
And, Paul, I know you didn't mean this as a slight, but or progressives in Vermont.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes, of course.
So we're going to be using this term, the Vermont Proposition. This is what you've – you know, you've taken what you've, the imp that you've gotten. This will be kind of the, Allie, help me out here. I think this is what you're going to use as kind of the guidepost for the summit. And then, my question for you, Allie, is how pleased are you with the input and progress that has been made so far going into the summit next week?
Well, that's one of the areas of hope, right? It's sort of how do you eat the elephant one bite at a time. And that's what I think VCRD does so well, too. Okay, there's this huge proposition. What do we need for our future in Vermont? And to be at a point where we have a document already with 9 identified priorities with, I would say, unprecedented levels of support behind the priority. That's something that I think is really important to note here. You know, as Paul said, thousands of Vermonters, you know, interviewing, putting in surveys, discussing this at community meetings, and we have 9. Well, that might sound like a lot to some folks. It's actually, you know, to have that process, have 9 themes that we hub around that people had really unbelievable levels of support. They really shone through as, you know what, no, to really have a functional Vermont society in the 21st century, these are 9 things that we really need. That's a huge starting point to go into this summit, because then, as Paul said, we can just go ahead and identify. I mean, we don't need to. I think what's really important, Rick, is I hear this from a lot of folks. How do we make sure we're not navel gazing?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
That's important to all of us. This is an action summit, right? This is an action proposition. And as Paul mentioned, the Council on the Future of Vermont, we have many examples of how this exact type of process, you know, sort of facilitated by a very seasoned group like VCRD, can really move from the abstract to the action. And that's what I think you have with these, with this document that has already been informed by so many discussions. And so that's where you can then leap right to partnerships. So who's on first for this one, and where's the funding coming from, and is funding needed, or is this, you know, more of a, you know, does this need some sort of oversight in some way or just some coordination? I think you can really get down to those next steps because we've already gotten to a point of sort of deep agreement and understanding that these are the things that make up the fabric of our society, and some of them need to be created the whole cloth, and some of them need improvement, and some of them need coordination. And so, you know, you're hearing a couple of them from us as we're discussing it, but, you know, broadband is an example of one. Obviously, as Paul said, childcare is another, inclusive communities and welcoming, you know, Vermonters of color and combating racism. You also have climate change. So you have these things that some of them feel perennial, but I feel like there's one step more granular detail here of what we really need to do under each of these buckets than we've had in the past. And that should really lead to some tangible movement.
And we're going to dive into as many of those as we can during this hour. Paul, in the document, in the proposition, it says that where's my notes here? It says that Vermont is at a turning point. In what ways is Vermont at a turning point?
A great question. I just want to plug before I go to it the website for people who are interested in registering, which
Excellent.
Is futureofvermont.org, www.futureofvermont.org. You know, leading some of the recovery efforts, we spent a lot of nights on Zoom calls with desperate Vermonters all over the state who were wrestling with, you know, they said stuff like, we're wrestling with desperate urgency to answer a situation that is unknowable and to look at, you know, what we can plan for in the face of an unknowable future. And, you know, when we started with pandemic response in March, you know, Evan was saying, well, in a couple months we'll be out of this. And here
right.
it is. You know, it just kept getting pushed out and pushed out and became bigger and bigger in terms of the impacts on people's lives. So when you think about this moment, there's some very practical work that we want to be doing in Vermont around COVID recovery, you know, economic redevelopment, you know, supporting the future of our downtowns, looking at recovery business to business, and how do we stimulate the redevelopment of businesses. You know, there's some holes in our downtowns. There's lots of new opportunities with the digital economy, and how do we not think we're going back to something, but how do we go forward to a stronger economy and stronger communities? Alongside of that, we have a national reckoning on racial relations. The death of George Floyd and the national reawakening of awareness of systemic racism and the barriers and oppression that people of color feel, not just nationally but here in Vermont, are having a seismic impact on the way that we think and on how our culture responds. And almost every organization, from the governor to town governments, are looking at what they do to become more inclusive. How do they encourage diversity? How do they consider fairness and equity in all of their work? And so this is another fundamental. Alongside that, we have a national breakdown of a sense of consensus around the way our government works. And we have had an attack on the Capitol in Washington on January 6th. We see sort of a breakdown in a sense of compromise and mutuality in our national culture around politics. And that's a fundamental threat to democracy that we can't be complacent about. And we can't put it on the back burner and think that it doesn't affect us or the future of Vermont. In fact, we have to aim right at it. And then, you know, science, with Governor Scott's leadership, we have seen an incredibly effective response to COVID-19 here in Vermont. You know, we have so much to be proud of. So many people doing what was right, protecting their neighbors, delivering food and going the extra mile for people, but also wearing the face mask, you know, doing what they needed to do for social distancing. So that our incidences were much less, our deaths were less, and now our vaccination rate is at the top. And that's just an enormous accomplishment. And it was done because we followed science and we looked at step by step at how you respond to a pandemic from a scientific point of view. That same point of view is going to be absolutely essential as we look at some of the other fundamental challenges that we're going to be facing, and in particular, climate change. You know, scientists have been predicting and are documenting the reality right now of cascading impacts that can have catastrophic implications, everything from fires out west to the drying of the Agualala aquifer, what it's going to mean for national and international food systems, the rising sea waters, and what's that going to have effect on populations in vulnerable places, some of which are already living beyond the ecological sustaining capacity of the land in different parts of the world. So these are fundamental issues that are going to confront the world as a whole, but they're going to have really strong impacts in Vermont as we establish our identity as a place that models solutions. And so a lot of the conference is really thinking big about what does Vermont do around each of these things. How do we, for example, instead of bemoaning climate change and feeling paralyzed by that impending, what scientists are telling us is impending, how do we think about the way that businesses and partnerships advance solutions to climate change? And, you know, you just had an ad from Green Mountain Solar. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of like the tip of the iceberg that there are businesses that are blossoming to answer climate change issues, everything from General Motors and Ford turning to electric vehicles to Casella's and other waste companies that are looking at, instead of throwing things away, how do we recycle into productive products for the future, everything that we used to think of as waste. So we have these economic opportunities for the future that we can seize, and in doing so, we can attract entrepreneurism, youth, and especially purposive young people who are looking to be part of solutions and not just, you know, passengers on this ferry. So we've looked sort of systematically at a number of different aspects of the economy, of community life, of the way government works to say, you know, at this fundamental moment, what are some of the levers for change that Vermont could seize upon? And again, looking at it as objectively as we can, apart from politics and party lines, what ought we to stand for as we look at change for the next generation?
Now, Ali Richards, we only have about a minute before we have to go to the CBS News, but coming out of the summit, who will be part of the coalition that will advance the results of the summit from next week?
Great question. It's going to be a mix, a very diverse mix of leaders, old, young, new Americans, folks who have been here for generations. I think the real crux of this is, you know, sort of a representative but small and mighty crew that is, you know, sort of the right size to make pragmatic change. And I just want to sort of also play off of what Paul said. Why do we do our best work in crisis, you know, in our recovery from Irene? Remember, we cut through red tape and we came together in so many ways. You know, even this vaccine rollout, look how smooth and universal that has been. All of the things we've done together through all of what we've seen in COVID, you know, these are the things that we don't necessarily need crisis to do our best work. So how can we have the summit and then the group that's going to carry it forward just really live into that, you know, the innovation and that urgency in a way that we can sort of hold on to some of these really important sort of, you know, game-changing ideals and practices. And I think that's what we're going to try to hold on to, that spirit, to move us through this and really position Vermont. You know, we're small enough, we're gritty enough, we should be able to go right after what Paul is saying, these sort of root causes, which is a lot of what you see come out as themes here. So I think you're going to see a small, diverse representative group of Vermonters who just care very deeply about moving this forward in a way that supports our fellow Vermonters.
We're going to take a break, go to CBS News. When we return, we're going to continue this discussion on the Summit of the Future of Vermont. Listeners, you can chime in, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. How do we create affordable broadband or total cellular access? How do we combat racism or welcome Vermonters of color or strengthen local businesses and foster entrepreneurship in the state? These are just some of the goals that have been set forth to be discussed at next week's Summit on the Future of Vermont. And with me are Paul Costello and Ali Richards from the Vermont Council on Rural Development to talk about the summit. Listeners, if you've got a question or a suggestion for our guests, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email VTViewpoint@radiovermont.com. Allie, let's talk about the summit and what will actually take place during the summit.
It's actually a little mind-blowing what Paul and his team at the Council on Rural Development have been able to pull together. It's one of the more complex virtual summits I've seen. I've seen a lot in this past year and a half, as we have all. Mm-hmm. But it's really hundreds and hundreds of participants who have opted in to be part of this conversation to, again, continue to move the process along. That is the next step, obviously, from these thousands of interviews and community conversations that have led to this document, which is a guiding document. And then you're going to see presenters. You know, you're going to see breakout sessions. You're going to see opportunities for discussion around general topics and then around each of these nine very specific propositions, right? So for, as you mentioned, you know, broadband, childcare, climate, you know, stewardship of our lands, and there's opportunity to further refine these things. And again, they're already more than a headline. You know, within the work that has led up to the summit, there are principles underneath each of these that sort of, you know, set a direction. And then I think that will be further refined in these breakout groups with these hundreds of Vermonters that are opting into the summit to then push it to a smaller group to carry forward into the action steps. So it's really a sort of a complex and dynamic summit from 1 to 5 next Wednesday and Thursday. And, you know, I think it's going to be one of the more I think energizing virtual conferences that you've seen. So I really do recommend, if this is of interest to folks, please do go to the website and sign up. This is a chance to put another sort of imprint on this plan that's taking shape.
Allie is absolutely right, Paul. I was blown away too, but when I looked over the schedule over the 2 days, it is jam-packed. And
it's amazing the number of people that are speaking. I think we have 115 moderators and panelists in this 2 day. And, you know, for me, the interesting thing is what's the rhythm of a discussion that makes you able to call it a summit. You know, it's not just a conference where people come and hear stuff and then go home. That first set of panels will be reviewing the proposition elements, and then we'll have diverse panels, everything from business leaders to investors to young leaders to people of color who've moved to Vermont from other parts of the world to investors. All evaluating the whole of the propositions and what makes sense to them and what they have questions about and so forth. And then the second day is all about everybody chiming in. And we're not going to do presentations. We'll have moderators who will draw people out in groups of 30 or 40 people to say, what are the ways that we would advance this proposition? What are some of the structural ways that we could work together? How would you like to be involved? And ultimately, build a bit of a game plan on how to advance those that are most important to people over the course of the next couple of years.
Paul, who do you hope attends the 2-day virtual summit?
A great question. You know, we because of who we are and because we're really closely connected to rural communities, we get a lot of community leaders, you know, people from select boards, but also people who have built a local project. They've developed a local daycare center, or they've participated in downtown redesign work. And so we see a lot of people who are unauthorized local folks just doing good for their communities. But we're also really connected to legislators, to state leadership in Montpelier. And we've done a lot of outreach because we think that this is a time for us to come together across party lines, where we want conservative folks and liberal folks to come. We want people who are relatively well off, and we want people who are who struggle in Vermont to participate. We want people of representing the full racial diversity of Vermont. So we're doing a lot of outreach to all people who reside in Vermont to come together in this really large conversation about our future.
There are nine elements in this Vermont proposition. And Allie, I'm not going to go in order. I'm going to skip right to number five because I know this is probably your favorite. Not that you're playing favorites, but it says that Vermont must ensure all children have access to affordable, quality child care education and education. So if you could kind of tell us, you know, what is going to be discussed there why you're particularly interested for people to take part in this one.
Well, I really appreciate that, Rick. And again, so you're exactly right. I happen to, well, I'm on the Council Rural Development Board, and, you know, this is a broader, as Paul is saying, this is above party lines and demographics and background. This is about community that brings us all together, which is the beauty of Vermont. We know this is in us. We know we can do this. And I happen to be grounded in the experience of high-quality affordable childcare. And the reason why I love being able to talk about this one as an example, because I do think it represents so many of the different points here. It is about going upstream, Rick. It is going to a root cause. And, you know, it's about prevention. It's about, a stitch in time saves nine, right? Mm-hmm. This seems like a real Vermont value that we've seen so many different times. And childcare represents that in such a beautiful symbolic way because it's about our kids. Of course, you'd start with our kids if we're talking about, you know, where do we begin in ensuring that we all have what we need. And so that's the reason why I love the idea of childcare. And it's become kind of, to sort of make the broader point about a lot of these pieces. I travel around the state, you know, at Let's Grow Kids doing this work, and it's almost become a joke where, I talk about childcare in all these different ways, and some people say, wow, that's so nice that you're focused on childcare. It's not really my thing, but I'm glad that you're thinking about this. And we really changed the conversation, and the pandemic certainly helped with that too. Wait a minute, tell me what you care about, and I'll help explain why childcare is your thing. You know, this movement in Vermont around high quality, affordable early child education, it's not because a bunch of people just have it as our hobby. It's because we've together identified a root cause that affects all of us. You know, when we're not giving kids and their families what they need to thrive from day one, we're actually paying dearly for that inaction over their entire lifetime. So it's not just the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do to really fix this. We have never as a society come to terms with the fact that our youngest children are just not in the home, either because their parents are working, because they want to work, because moms have careers, because they have, they have to have two incomes to meet and meet their single family homes, whatever it might be. The truth of the matter is, you know, 70% of Vermont kids under six have all available parents in the workforce, and yet only 3 out of 5 of our youngest Vermonters have access to the child care they needed, and that was before the pandemic. So if you see this through a lens of crisis opportunity, you know, which is exactly what you see here, we are in a crisis. For those who are lucky enough to find child care, you know, you feel like you won the lottery, even though you're paying 30% of your household income to then get that space. That's more right. than any other, you know, thing that you pay for in your life. And then if you're an early educator trying to do this really important job, you're making $13 an hour without healthcare benefits. So there's the perfect example of, wait a minute, let's pause. This is broken. This is not functional. And it's not the work, the beautiful, innovative work that's happening in childcare today that's not working. It's the system. It's the structures. It's the funding. These are things that we have the power to fix together. And when we do, we really weave back a hole in Vermont's fabric, you know, that we will, again, all benefit from, not just in a human way, but in a financial way as well. So thank you for letting me talk about it, because I really love, I mean, it has come up. It is proposition number 5. And I really think, again, it's where my experience is grounded in, but it helps me understand the importance of this whole effort. Because what we're talking about here, Rick, is I think all of these look at infrastructure in a little different way. When we have a pothole, we fix it. So how come when a child doesn't have what he or she needs in Vermont, we don't do whatever it takes to fix that? how come when someone can't work because their broadband is too slow or non-existent, we don't fix that? You know, there are some themes, again, that I think childcare really supports going upstream for these important pieces. So that's why I'm excited about to talk about what are the solutions. We're already seeing policy solutions. We're seeing community solutions. How can we move it to the next level to stop nibbling around the edges on this one and fix it once and for all as the foundation? And again, to make the point of all these propositions and how we will be discussing them at the summit.
There are eight more of these tenets in this proposition, but Paul, I'm going to ask you about number two, which states that Vermont must combat racism, celebrate our diversity today, and welcome new Vermonters of color. This is something that's almost near impossible, I think, to legislate or regulate. So what can we do in this state to make number two happen?
Boy, that is such a great observation, Rick. You know, this is something that is as much cultural as it is a policy discussion, right? I think that that it's fundamental to our sense of identity. When we did the Council on the Future of Vermont 12 years ago, we did a long evaluation of culture and what it meant to people to be a Vermonter. And we have a lot of pride in Vermont. You know, someone back then said, you know, Vermont's like Texas. We're really proud of ourselves because we stand for things. Mm-hmm. And we heard from, you know, scores of people who would start by saying, well, I moved to Vermont 18 years ago, but I guess I'm not a Vermonter yet, or I'm still a Flatlander. Or someone who would say, you know, I moved to Vermont and I joined the fire department because I wanted to contribute and I felt like that was the way to become a Vermonter. And so there's this strong sense of when people come, they want to belong. And one of the tough things that we're facing is that for many people of color, that feeling isn't easy to come by. You know, when I ask someone on the street, you know, where are you from? It may be because I care about their neighborhood. It may be because I know the towns of Vermont. I want to sort of situate them. But sometimes, you know, people ask that question of a person of color who's been here a few years or maybe even grew up here, and they feel like it's that they're being asked, you know, who are you? Why are you here? You don't look like us in this town, or maybe you don't belong here. And so without trying to necessarily have that kind of, you know, exclusionary sort of perspective, culturally we haven't listened to each other enough to understand that that goes on. And so we're really at this really powerful moment, I think, where we are trying to listen and we're trying to expand the sense of belonging and inclusiveness to everyone. And some of that may be policy around around fairness and opportunity for people of color and for all Vermonters. But some of it is just in how we think and welcome and invite people, you know, to our homes. Instead of, you know, thinking of people as different or feeling disconnected, you know, how do we build that sense of connection in our lives, in our businesses, in the opportunities that we offer to other folks? So, you know, every board in Vermont is thinking about how do we represent the people we serve better? How do we represent the diversity of Vermont? And how do we ensure that we're fair as we are advancing to a better society? And I think that, you know, fundamental to this is that that we share a background notion of justice, but we haven't really examined what that means as carefully as we ought to for a while. You know, a lot of the propositions connect to some ideals that have long history, and yet we have come to question a lot of our ideals, like, you know, what does patriotism mean? And we've become very, politically divided around what some of these things mean. And it feels really important to kind of come back together and listen to one another and try to think, how do we reactivate some of these ideals and some of the things that we stand for by thinking larger and by thinking more inclusively and by listening to those who may have been historically marginalized, maybe of a different amount of wealth or a different part of the state or more rural or versus more urban. How do we really hear each other and think towards, you know, what are some of the things that are self-evident truths to us together now that we can work on to move forward instead of concentrate on political differences and, you know, what Facebook produces, these mutually antagonistic bubbles of self.
Paul, let's try to get a call in. We got Freddie joining us from Facetown. Freddie, go right ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can hear myself. That's scary. I'm going to shut the radio off.
All right. I can't hear
myself.
All right.
The gentleman who's speaking he brought up a point about people asking where you're from, and it made people feel excluded. And I think that's not fair, and maybe it's an oversensitization,
mm-hmm.
because I know, you know, growing up here, we all used to know each other. And even now, when I meet customers, I don't care what color you are, what religion you are, anything about you, but, oh, where are you from? And my husband used to kick me under the table, you know, if we were at someone's house for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But it would turn out that, oh, do you know so-and-so? I know somebody from there. And you're trying to make a connection as opposed to blocking someone. And I think having an open mind about that is necessary to settle some of the uproar that's going on in our country right now.
Freddie, great point. We're almost out of time, so I'm going to take it from there. I grew up in a town where, and again, it's probably not the right thing to do now, but you'd hear someone's last name, and immediately you wanted to know what nationality they were because we were such a melting pot. And as much as that is a certain way of connecting, it can also be a way of dividing, and we all do need to be more sensitive of one another, of not only the person who's being asked, but the person who's asking the question. But we have a lot of work to do on that in Vermont, but it is a welcoming place. We can be much better, though, when it comes to racial diversity, and I hope number two can certainly expand that. I do want to get in one more question for you, Allie. By the end of next Thursday, what do you hope will have been accomplished at this summit?
I hope we have sort of a sense of a collective purpose. I think Freddie's question actually really hits at that.
Mm-hmm.
This is for all of us. You know, it's even, you know, proposition number two, why? Why should we be welcoming and have inclusive communities? It's not only for Vermonters of color. It's for all of us. Childcare is for all of us. You have kids or not, we all pay downstream if we don't take care of this. So I think it's this sort of a renewed sense of collective purpose, of some glimmers of tangible change to motivate us in moving forward so it doesn't feel like some overwhelming, heavy thing that's going to fall under its own weight, an identified group of people coming together to carry this forward in a more nimble fashion so it doesn't collect dust on the shelf. So, you know, I think we'll have an even stronger guiding document with, you know, benefiting from 2 days of conversation and feedback from that vast array of Vermonters, with, again, this sort of renewed hope and progress. And, oh, wow, I can see that this one partnership could unlock this piece and move it forward. I could see how this needs a policy solution, and how do we come together around that? You know, really tangible hooks that bring us to the next level, and then that can be passed along to the next iteration, which is this action team that will take all of this and push it into a true action plan, you know, with timelines and data, just like we do everything that we care about it and move forward. So, you know, I really do feel like hope is motivating. We need to come together, understand each other, continue to understand each other as humans, as community, and have this sort of summit help us come out of this pandemic, remind us we all here and we're here for each other, and we're gonna really work together to make sure our future is bright. That's what this is all about.
That's Allie Richards. She is the CEO of Let's Grow Kids and a board member for the Vermont Council on Rural Development. And we've been speaking as well to Paul Costello, Executive Director of VCRD. Thank you both for spending the time this morning to talk about the summit and what you hope comes out of it.
Thanks a million, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
Absolutely. And listeners, to learn more about the summit and to attend, here's where you can go. Visit futureofvermont.org/summit. futureofvermont.org/summit. We're going to break now for CBS News. When we return, Emma Cotton of VT Digger will be here to discuss her look at the state's fatal drug overdoses. And after a week of well-deserved time off, Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill is back. We'll get a weather update from him during the noon hour. I know you've missed him. It's always great to have his weather forecast. As a matter of fact, he sounds all bubbly after a week in the sun. So he has a very special forecast for us this week. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. During his State of the State address in 2014, Governor Peter Shumlin shared news we really did not want to hear. Vermont had an opioid abuse problem. Since then, a lot of energy has been expended to get that under control in this state. Our efforts have even been lauded by other states for their effectiveness. But as VT Digger's Southern Vermont reporter Emma Cotton has reported, we're losing far too many Vermonters each year to this scourge. Emma is here now to share what she's learned. Emma, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Emma about what she's found out or to share your own observations, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Emma, how many overdose deaths did we have in Vermont in 2020?
Well, we have a preliminary number on that, which does not include Vermonters who died out of state. But right now, the number that we have is 157 Vermonters. So that actually is more Vermonters than died of the COVID-19 pandemic. We had 148 Vermonters die from COVID-19. So that represented a 38% increase from 2019.
Wow.
Which is pretty substantial. Yeah.
Do we have any idea why the fatality numbers were so high for these drug-related deaths in 2020?
We do. I think the pandemic was, you know, a pretty big source of this. Isolation is hard for everyone. I think particularly for people who are struggling with substance use disorders, isolation can be sort of a dangerous thing. You know, I think you have people who are experiencing loss from the pandemic. So, you know, people maybe have lost loved ones or lost their jobs. And so I think that, you know, it was, as it was told to me, opioids are pain relievers. So people may be turning to opioids a bit more during the pandemic than normal. You also have, you know, the other dangerous part of isolation for people who are going through substance use disorders is if people are using alone, they don't have anyone to administer Narcan, which is the overdose reversing drug.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a real problem when people are by themselves and using. So those are, you know, the pandemic has really been challenging, I think, for people who are struggling with this. The other factor here is fentanyl. Fentanyl was less of an issue when Governor Shumlin gave his State of the State address, as you mentioned. At that point, I think the state was really looking to reduce the number of opioid prescriptions that it was sort of doling out, and the state has been pretty effective in doing that. Those prescriptions have come down by about 45%. But now we're seeing this increase in fentanyl, and fentanyl is incredibly potent. And a lot of people don't know, you know, how much is in the substances that they're using. So it really is driving up fatal overdoses quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to go over a few things. You really packed a lot of great answer into that, and I appreciate that. In addition to isolation, you know, when I asked about, you know, what's causing this higher number, wasn't this combined with closure of some treatment facilities as well in the state?
Yeah, so Vermont sort of maintains that many of the treatment centers have remained open. And, you know, in Burlington, I know Safe Recovery has kept some of their low barrier access to buprenorphine open, for example. But I know that Turning Point centers across the state did temporarily have to close, which I think is, you know, was pretty detrimental to people who were needing help in those moments. Yeah.
You also described opioids as pain relievers, and I want to make sure I don't make you know, some rash statement, but it's a physical pain reliever, right? It's opioids have a specific use to relieve physical pain, but I think what you were intimating was during these times of high stress, of loss, these can also be used to kind of relieve mental pain, the stress that people are feeling.
Yeah, you know, and I wouldn't be able to get too much into like the science of how opioids affect, you know, the way that people feel. But I think, you know, obviously heroin, for example, and some of these other opioids are giving people a euphoric sensation. And it might be similar to, you know, thinking about someone who suffers from alcohol, you know, addiction, who is sort of turning to these substances to, you know, maybe escape a reality, I guess. It's something that I think people do to escape more than anything else. So, you know, I'm not sure how it actually adjusts the chemistry of your brain, but it's certainly a coping mechanism, I think, for some people who are going through difficult periods in their lives. And I imagine that that use is only increased when those people are going through emotional pain.
I think that's a fair assessment, and I appreciate you not trying to go beyond, you know, what you really know about this. Now, you brought up one more thing, and I think it's important that we explain more about fentanyl, because this is really something to be concerned about. First of all, what is fentanyl, especially in relation to heroin, and why has it led to so many deaths?
Yes. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that is 80 to 100 times stronger than morphine. So this was found in 88% of Vermont's opioid overdose fatality cases in 2020. And the state is calling it currently the most prevalent substance involved in opioid-related deaths. So fentanyl, you know, is not something that's really, I think a lot of times it's manufactured sort of by people who are not measuring exactly what they're doing. I'm not really sure how to put that. But I think, you know, the strength of fentanyl can vary from, you know, one user to the next. So you're really unsure about how much you're taking. The other problem with this is, you know, as I mentioned, I think recovery coaches and people who are speaking with people who are actively using are saying fentanyl is appearing in, you know, all heroin at this point is laced with fentanyl. It also wears off more quickly than heroin, so people are taking it more often. So that's sort of obviously filling the body with more of this very deadly substance. And it's just, you know, it's increased the levels of fentanyl have increased over the years in Vermont. So this is something that's, you know, much more prevalent than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned that in 2014, I'm not even sure we knew the term fentanyl or had heard it much at all. So I still want to get some clarification, because this is a question I've had. You know, someone buys heroin, it's laced with fentanyl. I'm not sure why someone selling heroin would lace, would cut, you know, what someone's purchasing, the heroin, with something so strong? I mean, why is that advantageous to the drug dealer? You know, do you understand what I'm saying? What's the point?
I do.
why are we finding it in heroin? Because it seems like if someone goes to buy heroin, that's what they want. What does the fentanyl gain the seller?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I this is something that I don't know too much about,
sure.
But I think I would say I believe that it's cheaper.
Ah.
And I believe that, you know, people become much more addicted to fentanyl. And I think it's something that people sort of reach for. It sort of gives a different kind of euphoria and maybe a stronger euphoria. So I think it keeps people coming back.
Yep.
and purchasing these things.
All right.
So there's sort of some incentive there as well.
Emma, I appreciate that. I'm pushing you outside probably the realm of what you've written and what you've done, but I think it's important to understand it, and I think you've done a really great job. Now, one more question on fentanyl, and I think you did write about this, and that is the testing for fentanyl. I think that's something that there's been a push to have testing kits available for users so they know when fentanyl is present.
Yes, that's right. You know, and I know that this is something that the Howard Center Safe Recovery is doing. I spoke with Jeff Kirby, who's a case manager there. I think, you know, many organizations have and the state has sort of determined that it's important for people to understand what is in what they're using. What I also have heard, unfortunately, is that doesn't necessarily prevent people from using these substances just because they are powerful, and sometimes that can be, you know, alluring to someone who's having these cravings. But I know that, you know, that is part of the reason why we know that the levels of this are increasing in our state, is because we do have people who are testing their substances for it.
Emma, since Governor Shumlin's speech in 2014, what positive efforts have been put in place to quell the opioid crisis?
Yeah, so that was really the point where the state developed its hub-and-spoke model. And the hub-and-spoke model, for those who aren't familiar with it, hubs are intensive treatment where staff is really well-educated on opioid abuse disorders. And, you know, I think that's also where people who are struggling with these disorders can receive medication-assisted treatment. And so that, you know, that's sort of a starting point. And then after someone has sort of gone through that program, they're referred to different spokes, and Turning Point, you know, is considered one of those spokes. And those are sort of, you know, additional care that incorporates some opioid use treatment but isn't primarily focused on it. So there's been a lot of money and a lot of, you know, really coordination around this hub and spoke model, and the state really uses that as its primary way of treating these disorders. And I know that medication-assisted treatment is also expanding into different emergency rooms across the state, which is, you know, something that I think a lot of advocates are really lauding, because I think medication-assisted treatment is sort of the primary way that people can enter recovery. That's pretty important.
One of the things that was really eye-opening about your reporting, Emma, was the numbers of overdose deaths each year since 2014. So why don't you tell us about what's happened since that day, that speech from Governor Shumlin.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that sort of, I'm almost sort of ashamed to say, surprised me. I think a number of Vermonters maybe felt after that speech occurred that this was being addressed, and maybe that this was sort of, the situation had been ameliorated to some extent. But, you know, in 2013, the year before he gave his speech, 69 Vermonters died. In 2014, the next year, 63 Vermonters died. You fast forward to 2018, 130 Vermonters died. And then, of course, you fast forward to this year when 157 Vermonters unfortunately passed away. That number did decrease in 2019. That was the first time since 2014 when those numbers went down.
Wow. Is it felt that the efforts that were made by the state, though, actually did keep the number of overdose deaths lower than they might have been otherwise?
Yeah, you know, I would venture to say that that's probably a reasonable statement. I think there are advocates who continue to point to ways that things could be better. And I think one of those is for people who are entering recovery, it can be difficult to access some of these programs, even though, you know, the state has attempted to reduce the amount of time that people have to wait to enter them. Sometimes you still have to pledge that you're going to be completely sober when you're entering them. You have to, you know, get lab work done in some cases, and you're putting on the medical record that you have this disorder, which, you know, sometimes we take people's children away when we understand that they're suffering from opioid use disorder. People, I think, are really fearful to access some of these treatments and take that first step, which is partly why this bill is working its way through the legislature, and people are advocating for the legalization of small amounts of buprenorphine, which is a drug that helps people in recovery, when it isn't prescribed. So if someone, you know, on the street has accessed some buprenorphine, they will not be prosecuted for that. So I think this bill is just working its way through now. It looks like it's got some pretty strong approval from legislators, and advocates have been pushing this for a long time, and I think are pretty excited to see that come to fruition.
Buprenorphine, also known as Bup or Suboxone, and this is something when taken, I think, kind of satisfies a craving but doesn't provide the high. Am I correct when I describe it that way?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, this is a drug that really, it doesn't give a euphoric effect. It also is largely coming from pharmacies and can't really be laced with fentanyl. So this is a drug that is just curbing people's cravings and allowing them to avoid those withdrawal symptoms that I've been told by people who have entered recovery, you know, aren't so much uncomfortable as they are torturous. I think withdrawal is just this really ugly process that people are scared of. So to allow them to have this drug that sort of sidesteps that process or reduces the chances of it, you know, helps give people a bridge into recovery.
Now, Emma, in your article, you also cite something called opioid fatigue. So what is that, and how has that affected our attitudes towards or our efforts in the battle against this crisis?
Yeah, this is something that I spoke with Tom Dalton about. And, you know, I think there was so much attention paid to this issue in 2014. I remember, you know, and I live in Rutland, and I didn't back then, but I've read so much about the formation of Project Vision, which is an organization that sort of came together when Rutland was in the throes of going through this in 2013. The New York Times, you know, came out and covered that, and Rutland was sort of seen as this town that had fallen victim to heroin in many ways. And I think it was on the minds of so many people at that point in time. And like I said, it sort of, maybe there was the impression that it had been addressed to some extent after Governor Shumlin gave that speech. I think there has, you know, and Tom Dalton was sort of saying, it seems like, you know, maybe the media hasn't been covering it as much, or public officials haven't been talking about it as much. And we've all sort of, it's this really emotionally difficult thing to grapple with. And it just hasn't really been in the public eye as much as maybe it could be, considering the extent of the issue and the fact that it's gotten worse. It's only continued to get worse. And so, you know, I think there's sort of some, and I think maybe that's one of the things that this pandemic has done. It's so terrible that we've lost so many people. It's also shedding light on this issue, and it's maybe an entrance for some of us to begin understanding that this has been getting worse. So I think that might have also been part of why legislators felt some urgency to get this buprenorphine bill, you know, to really take a hard look at it this session.
I can remember, I'll say close to 2014, hearing about Suboxone or buprenorphine for the first time. And hearing people say, it saved my life, and yet the access to it was very difficult to get to then. It seems that has eased up, and now this bill could help those who are addicted to have more access to bup. So it could be a very positive thing. You mentioned lack of access to the system earlier, but you also write about the difficulty that people are having navigating this system for help.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh, who was it? Kyle Burdett just had sort of the most amazing quote about this, which is, you think about a person who, you know, has a lot of time carved out. They're sitting at their kitchen table. They're dedicated to figuring out where to go next and what to do. That person still might have a difficult time navigating the system. But then you think about someone who doesn't know where they're getting their next meal and doesn't know where they're going to sleep that night. And, you know, trying to, you know, for that person to try to figure out, okay, where do I go to get help? Where do I access treatment? I think it can be really challenging for people. And that's also why the Turning Point in Rutland, you know, I attended one of their cookouts on Thursday, and, you know, they have some people with signs and they're waving them in the streets and saying, come have a burger, come have a sandwich, you know, come in and just talk to us and we can help you try to navigate this, which was pretty powerful to me, you know, just trying to meet people where they are.
Well, that's great. One more thing I want to talk about. You mentioned this early on, and I think we should explain to people, too, the idea of Narcan or Naloxone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So the availability of this has become, you know, it's increased substantially as we come to understand how important it's been. And this is, it's just a drug that, you know, if someone is overdosing, you can administer it and it sort of immediately reverses the effects of an overdose. And I've heard that, you know, people sort of have strategies where they'll make sure that they're near someone with Narcan if they're, you know, planning to use so that the effects of, you know, if they do overdose, it can be reversed. It's also held in public libraries. You know, I think it's pretty standard for many police officers to carry Narcan at this point. So, you know, that's something that the state has definitely put into place as well and has sort of encouraged people to become acquainted with.
Emma Cotton is VT Digger's Southern Vermont reporter. I encourage you to read her story at vtdigger.org. Emma, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Great. We're going to get a news update from CBS, and then we're going to be back to hear your thoughts. We're going to open up the phones until 11 this morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint, and the phones are open. All right, here we go. Earlier this morning, we were discussing the future of Vermont. Are there some issues you think we really need to take care of in this state, especially those that you think no one is looking at? I'll name you interim governor again. You can enact some law or program that will make this a better place for everyone. Those who called in during that segment, it was right at the end, Freddie from Faiston Aaron, we didn't even get to from Burlington. If you'd like to call in and talk more about what you wanted to say, I'd love to hear from you. Freddie, sorry I had to cut you off and get that moving. We were right at the end of the hour, but you made a great point. I would love to hear you talk more about it. I could paraphrase, but I don't think I'd do a great job, but I'd love to discuss that with you. We've got NBA and NHL playoffs at this time of year. Season Bs are in, but how far do you think they'll go? What kind of job do you think Brad Stevens did this year with the Celtics? And if Bob Nelson of Nelson Ace Hardware in Barry is listening, we'd love to hear his thoughts on the Celtics. He really knows the C's. We also spent time eulogizing M. Dickey Drysdale of the Herald of Randolph yesterday. If you have a memory of Dickey, you can give us a call. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can also jump in with a subject of your own. We always appreciate when you start a conversation because sometimes that leads to something great. Sometimes it means I get on the phone and find a guest to kind of answer the question that you might have. I do want to share something that I got from Elsa Gilbertson. She was on Friday before last from Mount Independence over in Orwell, and she emailed me after the show later that day, and here's what she wrote. She said, guess what? You have a lot of pull. One of our seasonals and I, one of their seasonal workers and I, are at Mount Independence today to start to getting ready for opening. And eating lunch outside, two people came up. We started talking. The husband mentioned they were from the east side of Vermont, had a car service thing in the Burlington area this morning, happened to hear most of the interview about Mount Independence. They were looking for something else to do on that day while they were out, and so they came to Mount Independence. You got results, two visitors. I want to thank whomever that was who heard the interview and said, let's go explore a little bit more of Vermont. What a great result. Yeah, I love letting you know about what's out there, whether it's the Museum of Everyday Life up in Glover, or Mount Independence over in Orwell. I'm going to try to find those places for you. Sometimes it's a hiking trail or mountain biking trail or whatever it might be. We have so much packed in this little state, and it's worth the drive around to get out and enjoy it, see it. This is your state. There's wonderful places to eat. You cannot believe the great food until you pop into some of these little places. The general stores and country stores where we talked about last week that you can pop into, and it's a whole new world. You'll never know what you're going to find in some of them, and they are wonderful. If you have one to share, please feel free. I rattled off a bunch of them, as did our friend from Preservation Trust of Vermont, Ben. We just were having a great time letting people know. I was just at the Addison Four Corners General Store the other day. I had to go Friday. I was out that way, and I always have to stop in there, if for nothing else. So they smoke a brisket and different things. The deli was closed, but even if the deli's closed, you can buy sticks of smoked pepperoni, and it's a gift from the gods. It's like nothing you've ever had. If you're a pepperoni fan, this takes it to a whole new level. And it's worth just turning in and stopping in at these wonderful little places to see what they have to offer. And you just are amazed. And then you tell all your friends. I posted it on Facebook. And now I hope there's some new fans of the Addison Four Corners store. Great place to stop into. All right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Remember, if you don't call, then I just blab. I just go on and on, natter on for the rest of the half hour here. So please join in. Aaron from Burlington, I'm sorry we didn't get to your call right at the end of the discussion on the future of Vermont, but if you have a point to make, we'd love to hear it. Freddie, I hope you'd call back. So I'll paraphrase a little of what Freddie was saying, but I don't think I'll do it justice. But there is a way, and I think I grew up with it too, where you know, you're inquisitive. You feel it's welcoming to say to someone, well, where are you from? I mean, I still do it here. I've been here 18 years. I feel like a Vermonter from day one. You know, a lot of people don't. But I'm white. I'm male. I'm straight. I'm probably the least discriminated human being on the face of the earth. I will tell you that right now. I don't feel I have faced an ounce of discrimination in my life. So it's hard to put myself in other positions of people who don't have the same choices, or they are of color, and that stands out. And so when they're asked, I know, you know, Asians feel this, when they're asked, where are you from? They feel that might be somewhat racially tinged. Vermonters are inquisitive and I think welcoming in their way. And when they ask that, I don't think, at least for most of the Vermonters I've met, they don't think of that as anything being negative. And I think that was Freddie's point from Facetown. That is a Vermont way of being welcoming. I could be wrong, but I'd love to hear from Freddie to explain more her thoughts on it. But I think I'm pretty close to what Freddie was trying to say. And Freddie, I appreciate that call very much. We do have Steve from Websterville. Steve, good morning. What's going on?
Hey Rick. I wanted to tell people about the Lincoln Cover Bridge over in Lincoln, Vermont.
Yeah?
I was over there yesterday, and what a beautiful bridge. Mm-hmm. They put it all back together after I don't know if you heard about it, but that semi tried to go through it.
Oh, right. Oh, my.
And it did a devastating job. I had a guy showed me before pictures and during the project and all through it. And actually, I drove through it. There was a couple on the other side making out, by the way. But anyway, it was quite an ironic time. But yeah, the Lincoln Bridge, people have got to see it. You know, it's there's a lot of covered bridges in Vermont, and I know you had said you visited a lot of them.
Yeah, I have visited them all in Vermont, and 650 total. Now the Lincoln Covered Bridge is down there in Woodstock. Right?
In Woodstock, yes.
Yep.
Just outside of Woodstock.
Yeah. So, Steve, thanks. That's great. Oh, my gosh. You can, of the wonderful things that you can do around the state, you know, driving around and checking out the covered bridges, there's just about 100, I think, Steve, total. And you can make a wonderful trip. You can start your 251 club that way and see a lot of the state. And Steve said that there was a couple making out at the end of the bridge. So I'm going to give a little history on covered bridges, and that's part of it, Steve. So I'm glad you brought it up. So there are reasons why people ask why covered bridges, right? You could have just built a bridge across a stream or a river. You didn't need to cover it. So just remember that. It was all wood construction in the day, and the wood was taken from very close by, generally. So you used what was at hand. But the roof did several things. One, it protected the timbers, and so that is why a lot of these bridges have survived as long as they have, with little maintenance, until something like what Steve described happening to the Lincoln Covered Bridge in Woodstock. Another reason was you had, back in the day, horse-drawn carriages. You didn't have automobiles, and so horses could be spooked by the rushing water, and the covered bridge looked as if they were entering a barn, something they were used to. So, again, it was a way of keeping the horses calm and getting them just go right across on the bridge, so you did it that way. Now, the other reason that they mention in history, and Steve, this is to your point, was it was a great place for spooning, for young lovers to go and to make out a little. It was a place you could have just a little bit of privacy back in the day in the 1800s and probably early 1900s. So, Steve, that was just someone keeping up the history of the covered bridge, and we're glad they were doing it. But thanks for that report. Lincoln Covered Bridge, all repaired, and it's a beautiful one there in Woodstock. Yeah, so much you could do, you know, going from Websterville to down to Woodstock. You can just make a day of it. So I could map something out for you if you can't figure out what to do. Trust me. All right. And what else do I have here? I want to share an email. This came in from Beth yesterday, after yesterday's show, when we talked about M. Dickey Drysdale. He passed away a couple weeks ago. We had Bob Eddy, who's a photographer from the White River Valley Herald, on for a half hour, and it was a great conversation. And Beth wrote, "I ordered M. Dickey Drysdale's book after hearing your program this morning. I student taught at Randolph Union High School. While I never met him, he was spoken of often by my mentor, who was involved in the arts there in town. I really wish now that I had pursued a journalism job at the Herald before I changed my mind and went back for education." A lovely memory, even though Beth didn't know Dickey, was touched by his memory and touched by our discussion yesterday, and bought one of his books. I think it was Vermont Moments that she purchased because of the show. So love opening you up to the people around you, the places around you. And if you have either to share this morning, you want to let people know about a place to go in the state, you know, please share. It is such a wonderful piece of property we have here. Incredible terra firma. I think when people step on the ground in Vermont, there is a feeling, a certain aura that we get of kindness and wonder and love. And I felt it the first time I got here back in 1994 and then moved here in 2003. And I still feel it every time, every moment I'm here. When I drive back to Pennsylvania and get back to that state line, you know, some people say it's, oh, well, there's no billboards. Yeah, that's part of it. That's the pristine look of it. But it's more a feeling that I get, a welcoming, a warmth that I've always felt from the first time I got here and from when I moved here. Let's see. We've got memories of Dickey Drysdale. They're welcome. Thoughts on the future of Vermont. Welcome. If you want to call 244-1777, 877-291-8255. What are you thinking about the Red Sox, especially weighed against your thoughts before the season started? They have been in first place now. So they start out 0-3, and we thought, yep, here we go. This is the season we were kind of predicting, right? They rattled off 9 straight. And they've been in first, you know, ever since, and playing good ball. Just slightly, I think, above 500 since then. But, you know, they look like a real team. There's enthusiasm. There's hustle. You know, what more could you ask for, right? And the pitching staff had a lot of questions. We don't have Sale, right? 25-17 right now. Is that the current record? So from 9-3. They've gone, what, 16-14? That's not too bad. All right. Any new music that you're enjoying? You know, I always have some oddball stuff. Father Son, Smooth and Terrell, Lanterns on the Lake, the Country Westerns. Those are some new ones I've been listening to, some that I've been finding and loving lately. You can share some. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And if I have to do a monologue for the next 5 minutes, I might lose my voice. So call in. Maybe you want me to interview you. We could do that. I've done that a few times. You call in, give me a subject. I'll ask you a few questions, and we'll meet you. The listeners will get to know you. Again, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. 8255. And don't forget that I'm always looking for guests or ideas. It takes a lot of my time, but it's well worth it, especially when you can suggest topics that I don't really maybe know about or haven't thought about. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Or call in now, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Always great to hear from you, get feedback from you. I do appreciate that you listen and that you, yeah, you let me know what's going on in this beautiful world. All right, what do we got here? We got Jack calling us. We'll get him on in just a moment. Jack, how you doing? Go right ahead.
Not too bad. Hey, I got some good new music for you. It's local.
Yeah.
Chromatic harmonica player named John LaRouche has an album out, Cerulean. And features a lot of Vermonters, Levent Yanal, Tom Cleary. Some of the folks will be at the Discover Jazz Fest. And just a great album of locally produced jazz. Classics like Miles Davis's Blue and Green. Some originals on there, but it's dandy listening.
How do you spell LaRouche?
LaRouche. He also made an album with Emily, I forget her last name, the pan drum player from Panache. They've played in downtown Waterbury a couple times. He's one of the two go-to guys for chromatic harmonica in the Green Mountain State.
All right. And do you know what color cerulean is?
It's a type of – I studied art in college. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it's a type of blue.
Yep, you are correct.
Yep.
And you are pronouncing it correctly. Cerulean is blue. Well done. All that money we spent on you in college, Jack, and it paid off. It really is.
Man. Still paying that off.
All right. Let's see. John
LaRouche. Have a good one, bud.
All right. Thanks so much. John LaRouche, Cerulean is the album, and that's recommended by Jack over in Moscow. And did we find out who the Black Keys just released an album this week? Okay, there's a good suggestion. Black Keys, boy, that's been a while, hasn't it, for them? I could be wrong. Black Keys, White Stripes. Oh, big difference, right? Black Keys, right? Got it. All right. All right, we still have a few minutes here, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. A couple years since Black Keys, 2019, when they last released one. Is that what we're saying here? Okay. Danny feeds me all the information. I know absolutely nothing. Danny McGimrigan, the director of the show, is working hard to answer phones and then to make sure that I have bits of information. 244-1777 and 877-291-8255. Might get a sneaker in here before the end of the show. And don't forget, we've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. That's coming up this morning after NBC News. And, when do you think we can start to ease up on that? They started with 3 a week, got down to 2 a week sometime last year. And I'm hoping that the governor and his staff, and, you know, it would be a great sign of where we are in recovery after this pandemic, that we get down to just 1 a week, and then Governor Scott and his staff wouldn't have to rally every few days to be on the air. But right now they really have to. But there's a lot of preparation that goes into that. And I will let you know that Governor Scott will be on with me next Wednesday at 10:30. So if you're looking to chat with the governor, we'll have him here on Vermont Viewpoint. All right, that's a wrap for today. Tomorrow we're going to hear from John Sales of the Vermont Food Bank and also the owners of the Reap and Sow Farm in Hinesburg. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by that wizard over there, Danny McGivergan. Our email address, VTViewpoint. Oh, he didn't like that because the Celts are playing the Wizards tonight. So sorry about that one. Email address, VTViewpoint@radiovermont.com. And past episodes, you can listen to the podcast, download them at WDEVradio.com. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.